I have hit record. Can you hear me okay? Am I loud enough?
You're good, man. Okay. You and that little fan.
Yeah, me and my little fan. It's actually a big window fan I got cranked in here, because last time I had the door closed when I cast it, and my computer generated a lot of heat, and I was sweating pretty bad by the end of that.
Oh, good!
Got to get out that compressed air.
Yep. Well, anyways, welcome to Card Knock Life, episode 14. I'm here with my co-host, John Galley.
What up?
And Daryl Fulton.
Heyo!
And I'm Corey Murphy. Of course, we don't have Brandon today. He's like, I don't know, maybe this was last week, his excuse. He was on a plane to Detroit.
He's dead. He went to Detroit.
He's doing some traveling.
He's working money.
He went to Detroit and now he's dead.
Oh,
okay. We apologize.
So he might not be back next week unless there is any kind of reincarnation going on.
I've seen Brando. He pops up from time to time in Madison. He'll just jump into a tournament and I'll be like, Brando, what are you doing?
I think it's like that movie The Prestige where he's got like a twin of himself that just kind of shows up every once in a while. Oh, spoiler alert. That's what happens in that movie.
That movie's sweet, by the way, you guys.
Thanks, because I actually wanted to watch that on Netflix.
You should still go watch it. That movie's awesome, dude.
I don't think it'll ruin the movie for you. You probably guessed that almost the entire time, but hey, that's what happens.
That's a Christopher Nolan movie, so, I mean, you should already be well-versed in the Nolan.
Yeah, thanks, bro.
That won't spoil it for you. You gotta still go see it. So.
Which was the latest Christopher Nolan movie?
Not Inception. What was the space movie? Interstellar.
Oh, Interstellar. Yeah, right. Have you seen that?
Yeah. I saw it. I think it was pretty good. It was not my favorite Nolan, but it was definitely, like, reasonable.
Okay, because I have never seen it, but I've heard a lot about it. And based on those reactions, I can only believe it's, like, M. Night Shyamalan, The Village or something. Just, like, the very mix, like, hot and cold.
It's a letdown from his previous ones, because the story is kind of, like, thin, but it's, like, the effects are still, like, Nolan spectacular and stuff, so... Okay. I would see it. It's definitely not one I would miss because like McConaughey's just on a roll too. He's been awesome.
Yeah, man, he was even good in that Lincoln commercial where he's rubbing his fingers together with the kids.
Well, I don't know if you guys watched the first season of True Detective, but that's probably one of the best shows I've seen in like the last 5 years.
Oh yeah,
he's just like insane in that show, and it's only 8 episodes, so it's definitely worth like figuring out where it is, HBO or iTunes or something. But
nice. Yeah.
Anywho.
Oh, okay, before you go on from this topic, you gotta check out on Netflix or Hulu, Netflix. There's a show called Sense8 that's only on Netflix.
I watched the whole season.
Oh, man, that's damn good. It's by the guys in The Matrix, but it's even better than The Matrix.
I'm glad to hear you like that, Corey, because, like, I watched that show and I'm like, I'm really enjoying this, but I wonder who else likes this show.
Oh, it's good. It's got an in-depth and, like, intelligent plot, whereas, like, if you hear the Matrix guys and you're like, oh, man, that movie was so, like, 1998.
It's kind of
1998 fantastical violence, so this is not.
The good thing about this show is, for one, it's, like, super diverse, so, like, hopefully if you're culturally open-minded, you'll have something you like in the show. And then the Matrix guys did some of the episodes, and the guy who did Run, Lola, Run, like a pretty famous German director who did a bunch of techno movies and stuff. And then Saeed, that was the guy he played in Lost. Is one of the main actors in it and stuff. So yeah, it's sweet. Daryl, have you seen any new shows?
No, not particularly. I've been adulting way too hard and getting in car accidents and yeah.
But you know, Daryl, the best show of all time according to like Metacritic reviews is The Wire, and you live that every day in Baltimore.
Yes, you do.
No, I don't. I don't ever see... what is that, a drug show, I assume?
It's about crime in general. I don't know too much about it.
It's about the crime scene in Baltimore and, like, the drug trafficking trade and stuff.
Oh, okay, good.
I watched, like, it is considered, like, one of the best shows of all time, even though I watched, like, 2/3 of the first season and wanted to take, like, 6 showers, but...
Wait, yeah. 6 showers because of, like, how...
Dude, it's just, like, super depressing and dark and dirty. Like, it's a well-made show, just like, you know, all these shows that are out there. But it's a pretty hardcore stuff, so...
If you didn't buckle your seatbelt, you wouldn't be okay?
Yeah, it's pretty much in that realm. But it's kind of like Breaking Bad. I did the same thing with that. I watched, like, 2/3 of the first season. I was like, yeah, this is just so dark. Like, I like that kind of stuff normally, but... Man,
I watched like 3 seasons of Breaking Bad before it got too redundant, and I quit watching it. So,
It looked well made, but it's just like, I can't binge watch those shows. I've got to have some light at the end of the tunnel sort of thing. I don't know.
Sure.
So now we got our magic, non-magic information out of the way. We should skip that at the end of the show.
Shall we talk about Prads now?
All right. Daryl, I see you've got like a lot of kind of rogue decks at the Pro Tour on your list. Is that right?
Not super rogue. They're just kind of like things that didn't stand out. You know, like the deck of the hour there. I mean, we know that Mono Red John won. Yeah. But the deck of the hour was sort of the blue-red Thopters, almost like a combo deck. Oh, so yeah. That was sort of the big deck. But these are a lot of the big hitters that placed well in Standard and just kind of were off the radar. And we're going to start with the genius himself, B.M. Kibler.
Okay. So here he is. Wait, you got to pause it. You got to do it. Here is Daryl stuff, because I got to throw in that little bumper. Here is Daryl stuff.
There is a bumper. I forgot.
All right. I'm glad you brought up these lists too, Daryl. I'm going to let you go nuts on this, but like, I didn't get a chance to see what lists actually went like 9-1 or whatever. So this is kind of interesting.
There were four lists that went 9-1. Two of them were Mono Red Aggro, pretty much the same one that won the tournament. The other two were quite interesting. One of them was the man, the myth, the dragon master, American Joel Larson, or Brian Kibler, as you all know him and love him. Just playing green white knuckleheads. That's the only way I can describe this deck. It's just Elvish Mystic, Fleece Mane, Den Protector, Death Mist, Boon Seder, Nissa, Warden of the First Tree, Hidden Dragon Slayer, Corsair Crucifix, Ajani, Mentor Heroes, Drogue's Command, Valor Stance, lands. And then the nice little sideboard package of Hangerback Walker plus Evolutionary Leap, which is a combo for those of you that don't know how that works.
Mm-hmm.
And then two Tragic Arrogance, which is also hilarious. That card was very good during the Pro Tour, and I think it will be very good in Standard moving forward just because of the Cataclysm style effect. But this is just... This deck had enough in it to go 9-1 against a lot of the red decks and things like that, because it's got, you know, a little bit of built-in life gain with Corsair Crucifix. I consider Dromoka's Command life gain because you're countering a burn spell and then fighting one of their guys and probably killing it, or you're edicting their Eidolon of the Great Revel, or however you would like to look at Dromoka's Command. But it's so flexible against the red decks. And then you just have a nice, robust clock with, you know, Deathmist Raptor and Warden of the First Tree and Fleece Mane Lion. You have a nice robust clock that can keep people sort of off balance. And then just a bevy of reasonable sideboard cards. The most impressive probably being the Hangerback Walker Evolutionary Leap card advantage engine. You know, playing Hangerback Walker, making it like a 4-4, and then Evolutionary Leaping away, making 4 Thopters, drawing a card essentially by getting a creature, and then Evolutionary Leaping each one of the Thopters away, drawing an actual creature. Sometimes that creature's Elvish Mystic, and you're really disappointed. But sometimes you get something like Den Protector, and you just crush your opponent. So you just bury them under card advantage.
This Kibler, list is... Yeah. Go ahead, Corey.
Kibler's all about that Ajani Mentor of Heroes, man. I think I've seen
that before. That card is insane.
It's sweet. It never gets played. And there have been plenty of decks that have green and white in them. It seems like it could be slotted into the John decks okay, too. But he doesn't, like, pass, like, the like, typical, like, Planeswalker litmus test where like they make a dude to block or protect them or whatever, but instead he just makes a dude that's already there bigger, which these decks all have because they've all got Elvish Mystic, you know, they've all got Sylvan Carradine. To put those counters on a Sylvan Carradine sounds sweet.
Yeah, plus the just built-in card advantage of I'm going to draw a creature and my deck is like 30 creatures, so most of the time I'm going to draw a card.
I think that's the beauty of this list too, man. Like Kibler's playing all value cards. Like this is an aggro deck, but he has got a ton of value here. Right, you got 4 protectors, you got the full Megamorph package, you got the Hangerback Evolutionary Leap out of the board, the Ajani. Like he is not like losing out on cards. He's almost playing like a blue deck in a green shell.
I would argue that green is the new blue. As in, green is the card advantage engine color for the next X years, where X is, you know, Corsair Crucifix into Den Protector, and Corsair Crucifix will rotate, but we'll still have Den Protector. So barring Battle for Zendikar kind of pushing green towards a ramp strategy with Avenger and Oblivion Silver and things like that, mm-hmm. green's going to be your control color for card advantage, I think.
Well, it certainly has been for standard right now, and like it certainly could be for the future if Wizards keeps pushing that angle. But yeah, I mean, this list is like a shining example of everything, you know, blue-wise that you can do with green. Like, I like how you were saying, like, he's got, like, 28 creatures here, which is quite a bit, too. And, like, he's got Nissa, which is even another value card we didn't really talk about. I mean, every creature here, pretty much, aside from Elvish Mystic, does something extremely relevant.
Right.
Yeah.
And I like, his sideboard is insane. Like, I have not seen a sideboard anything close to this with, like, Unravel the Aether for the enchantment decks and random stuff you need to deal with, like the combo that he has in there. The Tragic Arrogance, underrated.
So Unravel the Aether is actually there for two reasons, and it's not enchantments. It's there for Hangarback Walker and Darksteel Citadel. Because if you make a Darksteel Citadel 5/5 with its solar effect, you put the Darksteel Citadel on top of their deck, or shuffle it into their deck. Yeah.
It's so definitely very good in.
Yeah, and then, you know, taking those 3/3 and 4/4 Hangarback Walkers and turning them into net nothings is trading 1/1 with Hangarback Walkers really hard. And the only cards that can really do it are Last Breath, but if you play a, or like Abzan Charm, but it just, neither of those cards really fit into the strategy. So Unraveling the Aether also being able to kill Darksteel Citadel, kind of a huge boon to killer strategy here. But yeah, just like, it's like you would look at it and go, this looks like, my first constructed deck that I would, like, see all these sweet green creatures and be like, but I want to play that lion, and the Johnny's awesome, so let's just put it all on a deck. And you'd be like, there's no way that's, like, 9-1 quality in the Pro Tour.
Remember that green-white deck that we had before, like, cons? That just
I know the one you're talking about.
There was a green, that had Sun... What's the elf? The
one maybe I'm talking about a different one. Sunblade Elf or something like that. The one that pumps your team or something.
Yeah. That deck was cool, but the problem with it was it just ran into too many dead ends, right? Like, if you drew too many lands, you'd have nothing to do, and you just lose, because you were out of the game. Because you played a bunch of creatures that were under-costed, but they just didn't have any utility. And this deck is exactly that deck, which I think Kibler played, but now there's so much utility in it. Like, you can pour your mana into the Fleece Mane Monstrous. You can Den Protector flip. You can Deathmist Raptor flip.
Warden of the First Tree Palms. You know?
Right.
A Johnny.
And I think
at
that's
5.
The difference with those two. Like, I think this has a lot more potential to play that long game if it comes down to it. And that's what you need to be able to do in a deck that just might draw, like, 6 lands in a row.
Also, my favorite combo in this deck, Hangarback Walker plus a Johnny.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
That's sweet.
That's really dumb.
All of the value. I'll play this 2/2 Hangarback Walker. I'll tap, I'll play a Johnny. I'll put 3 counters on it, make it a 5/5, and Evolutionary Leap it away. Yeah.
This deck looks really dumb.
The Hangarback Walker now looks like close to $18.
Yeah.
According to this.
Goldfish.
I mean, this is a list, as much as I'm a red player, if I had the cards for this deck, I would play this in a heartbeat in, like, the next week. This deck looks super good. Like, Corey, I don't know if this is kind of along the lines of what you were talking about, but, like, when you and I went to that PPTQ a little while back, there was a green-white company deck, which is basically this exact style of deck, except with a little less value, maybe, and it top-8ed there. Like, it went undefeated in the Swiss at that PPTQ. And then I went to one on that Sunday, and there was also another deck just like it that also did the exact same thing. So, like, I think this was kind of like a hidden radar deck. Like, you didn't see it pop up that much, but it was always very effective whenever I saw it.
I'm talking about, like, way before that, like M14.
Oh, a while back. Okay. Yeah.
So
I know what you're talking about, and that's a good one, too.
I brought you Kiblu the God and his relatively expensive...
Before you go on, though, Daryl, I just want to mention the Collected Company, though, because, like, why wouldn't he include that here? It seems like a card you want in this kind of deck.
You're playing extra misses in things like the Johnny and your Valorous Stance and Jeroboam's Command. So you're playing a few extra misses. You're still on that 25 to 28 creature cuff. But I don't think that, like, taking a turn off to, like, play Collected Company is what this deck is looking to do. Like, it's just looking to just continue to put pressure on your opponent and make them have answer after answer after answer. And it feels like Collected Company might be a little awkward just in the shell. I think you just wanted to play, like, very smooth just like creature, this just like curving out, which sounds really weird because it feels like Collective Company would curve out, but I think he's just like wants to go 1-3 and then like 2-2s.
Yeah, you're right, John. Well, he's exercising a lot of restraint not putting it in there, right?
Yeah, I mean, like, the thing is that it would go in the slot where, like, a Johnny is usually. Like, usually those Collected Company lists like this would play Dromoka's Command and Stance as well, and a similar creature count. But, like, the thing that you could do with Collected Company, as much as curving out is awesome, like, we're in a format where Languish is a thing. And so against, like, Abzan and against, like, dedicated control decks, you could just, like, company at the end of their turn, and if they counter it, then you can just like dump a bunch of aggro dudes on the table, or like monstrous your fleece mane and stuff like that.
So,
or you've got Valor's Stance, you make your creatures indestructible. Oh, that doesn't work for language, does it?
No, it doesn't.
Yeah,
it might just be that Johnny does more against the language.
Sure, actually, Johnny's like a really good follow up to language, and one of the things that this list in particular would probably do good against that sort of deck is that. Like, since you've just got sheer value out of almost every single creature here, you may just not need something like Company, because, like, you just want a more active spell.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. I think that Johnny just does enough. And Collecting Company doesn't have any synergy with Hangerback Walker out of the board, which is kind of not... It's not extremely important, but it's something to note that, like, you're breaking some synergies that he built across the deck.
That's true, actually, yeah. This list does kind of centralize around the concept of going into Hangerback Walker or using a Johnny for extra value. So I guess I can see that point there. I mean, this list is just impressive, but... All right, yeah. Lead us on.
So I brought you an expensive deck that, John, you may not have the dollars for. I don't want to pay that much for a standard deck. How about I bring you something a little cheaper? Under $200 in paper. 9-1 at the Pro Tour. Rug midrange. I refuse to call it teamer. Rug midrange.
Oh, yeah.
Savage Knuckleblade, Thunderbreak Regent, Stormbreath Dragon, Mystic, both of the Mystics, Elvish and Rattleclaw, Corsair Crucifix, Boon Seder, and Arbor Colossus, a Polukranos, 4 Crater's Claws, 3 Stubborn Denial, 2 Roast, 2 Anger, 24 lands of various varieties, and then the sideboard, 3 Disdainful Stroke, 3 Destructive Reverie, 2 Roast, 2 Anger, 2 Den Protector, 2 Feed the Clan, and the 4th Stubborn Denial. Blue-green red dudes.
Teamer's so weird.
What more can you say about it? It's just a pile of guys with some counter spells and some creature spells.
Yep.
Yeah, it's pretty similar to what we've seen like from previous teamer lists. There's not a lot of change here, but I will note that I've had like a bunch of standard decks in my bag for like the last couple months that I always use to break out for games and testing. And one of them is a teamer deck. It actually might be this guy's deck. I think this guy is the same guy who won the RPTQ in Santa Clara, because that's the deck I've had in my bag. And I'm pretty sure this is the same guy in the same deck for the most part, because he's got the main deck, Anger the Gods, and the Coursers. And like, this deck has always played extremely well against the format. You cover both ends of the spectrum, like the high and low, and you have main deck Anger and main deck Roast to kind of throw off like the metagame choices that people have. So I think it's pretty good. It's just unfortunately it falls to like some of the stuff that Teamer has, where you can die to your mana, you can die to like really awkward hands, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's the price you pay for a 3-color deck, in all honesty. Like, the one Arbor Colossus is kind of clunky as far as mana goes, but otherwise this looks... The mana looks about like an Abzan deck's mana.
I think his build here, different from other teamer decks, is that he is just like going to guarantee himself ferocious, right? So he's got Savage Knuckleblade, Thunderbreak Regent, 4 of each of those, 3 Stormbreath, 3 Boon Seder, 1 Arbor, 1 Polukranos. He's going to have a 4-power dude on the table at all times. So then his 4 Crater's Claws become shocks if he needs them to be. His Stubborn Denial protects any of his creatures if he needs it to. That card is insanely good in this sort of deck.
Yep, just...
And he can... like his,
Stubborn Denial is really good.
Game 2 and Game 3 options are almost like a control deck where he just, like, sticks a threat and protects it, you know? Because he's got Disdainful Strokes for the Languish and for the Wrath. He's got...
Stubborn Denial for the pinpoint removal spell. Yeah, I mean, this deck seems really fine, like... But if you're looking for something cheap, under $200, get it while it's hot.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the pieces of this deck are cheap. And, guys, I did a little research while you were going about that, and it is the same guy who went XO and got first in Santa Clara.
Nice.
So I put his link in the podcast, the last one in that, and Daryl, your section there. And he didn't make too many changes from that list to the Pro Tour list. He cut, like, Serac the Hunt Caller. He had a one of in there. And it looks like he cut the Reality Shift, and he basically made them into Roasts and the Arbor Colossus Pelucranos stuff.
Right, after so, Reality Shift.
Yeah, oh, okay. Exile a dude and they get a 2-2. It's 2
yeah, and a, that's real. Speed. That's real bad. That
it was actually pretty sweet in the list, man, because like, it's super flexible, but I think Roast just probably like, you know, covers most of your bases the same way, but like, it doesn't have the limitation of Roast where it can't hit flyers. And yeah, it's just basically two mana, like, kill anything in the format. You just have the drawback of giving them a 2-2.
Yeah, but I mean, that's a super reasonable deck for those of you who are looking to build on somewhat of a budget. That's, I mean, as far as Magic budgets go, that's pretty good. So, I mean,
it is really cheap. This is kind of surprising. I'm looking at the prices on your link here.
It's literally four Wooded Foothills, and you have, what is that, actually more than a third of the deck price.
Yeah, so, I mean, Savage Knuckleblade is like 50 cents at our local shop and stuff. Like, yeah, this stuff's cheap.
Now, this go ahead, John.
I was just going to say there might be some stuff rotating here, but it's actually not too bad. And you could play stuff like the new Sarkhan instead of Storm Breath and that sort of thing.
All right, that card exists.
Although, yeah, for your stubborn denials, you might want like another four power guy like Ashcloud Phoenix or something. So. Yeah.
I think that you can lose to bad draws much easier in this deck than others because of the curve being set at, like, you know, three for any of your threats.
I think if red is popular, you got to be very careful with lists like this, too. As much as you have Anger and Roast and stuff, you have three mana Confluence in your land base, and they have, like, Searing Blood right now and all the burn spells to clear the way and stuff. So, like, Teemer's biggest weakness in general was that it would have a really tough game against Mono Red at times. I think this guy, like, hedges it really well since I've played this list a ton. Like, the Courser Anger combo is really good, and a lot of Teemer lists don't run that. But, yeah, you got to know, like you were saying, Corey, like, there are some draws where you're just going to lose because it's super clunky. But granted, any deck kind of has a little bit of that.
Yeah, I guess so.
If they institute the Pro Tour rule, too, where you get to scry one, that makes this deck a lot better.
I've actually seen a lot of the pros talk about that, and they said they think it's fantastic for Limited, it should be kept, and it's terrible for Constructed.
Terrible?
Yeah, I have not seen that at all, Daryl. I've seen, like, very much positivity across the board, so I'm curious where you're seeing some of that.
They're saying it's terrible just based on, like, what it will do to some formats. It will sort of push the combo-oriented decks to mulligan more aggressively towards their combos and things like that. Like, the Blue-Red Thopters deck can mulligan more aggressively because they have the extra looks for, you know, what pieces they're missing. Sure. Or in modern decks like Bloom or Twin or, yeah, you know, whatever. Yeah, Delver, not so much. Delver's not a huge deal, but like...
Well, yeah, Delver, because you can set it up. I mean, I've heard the Delver aggro and combo argument, but I've heard that's also, like, the weak tip argument from a lot of people, and that, like, most of the people I've seen talking about it have been, like, really in favor of it. But I think they're going to change it regardless, because even the coverage guys were saying that they wanted to, like, probably adjust it a little bit, but that, like, there was some positive... benefits yeah. there.
Oh, no, there was a ton of positive for Limited, and it mixed back for sure.
So it's not actually officially the rule now? That was just like a test run on it?
It was a test run, yeah.
Literally a test run. Oh.
So. And unfortunately didn't help the guy, Mike Segrist, in the finals with his mold of three.
Yeah,
in the last game.
Yeah, ye olde mulligan to three. There were a couple keepable hands in there. But,
yeah, he should have kept on five. LSV was right. LSV was spot on that coverage. Everybody else was knuckleheading it.
Welcome to Magic coverage.
All right.
Onward and upward. We had one blue control deck that really stood out. That went 8-1-1 by Robin Dolar. Just Esper Dragons, like three Jace Spirits Prodigy in the sideboard, which I find kind of questionable. I'm not 100% sure. I mean, I guess you want that in the control mirror because they don't really want to downfall your Jace Spirits Prodigy, so you get the loot for a while and then flip it.
Daryl, like, this is, like, I think the best shell for Jace, man. He's super really? In these kind of lists, yeah. You have a real ability to protect him, and he's like super insane at keeping your game plan going.
Yeah, this is just a thing I don't know. That's why I'm just kind of like looking at it like, in the sideboard, I don't know how I feel about it. I can see it in the main board. I don't know.
Well, he's a looter, and, I mean, he's a Snapcaster Mage. I think the reason you put him in the board is because the mono-red matchup, you don't want him at all.
Yeah, I would have to play this deck to, like, understand why things are the way they are.
But there is the argument that, like, he can die to removal, but I think the matchups where, like, dollars bringing him in is where, like, he knows he'll be able to protect him, where, like you said, it's a control mirror or a matchup where there's not as much removal.
Yeah, like
against Devotion, like, they can't do anything about him, so he just goes off.
I think he's kind of too slow against Devotion, because you really want to go to that ultimate, like...
Yeah, like, it may not be the card you bring in there. It may just be a control mirror card, too.
Yeah, like, because that ultimate, like, wins a control mirror, and, like, being able to loot away the bad cards in your control mirrors are, like... Having more card selection is insane. So, but yeah, like, this deck looks really, it just looks like a Dragons deck. Like, somebody decided he had some Mogetides laying around, and he went to sleep up and go to town. Like,
he's really good. He's also, this guy's like the control master, too. This guy's like the brainchild behind, whatever the Ivan Flock, the guy that won the Pro Tour like 3 Pro Tours ago or something.
Yeah.
This is like his mentor and stuff. This guy's like a Wafo Tapa type. You know, He's very good.
Like, the only thing that looks super, super weird besides the Jason sideboard is, like, one main board Antioch. Just one. No more. But, like, I like the split on Crux of Fate and Languish. I like, you know, the spot removal, the Stormguard Scorns. I might want a third Dissolve. The mana base seems fine. Like, it's a really well-built control deck. Like, one Anticipate seems kind of wonky, but okay, I'll buy it. You know, stuff like that.
Yeah, I think the Ashiok thing, Daryl, like, it's, you know, I think, like, I've talked to some control players. Like, I know Trevor did pretty well with control at regionals. And I think Ashiok's just, like, such a debatable card because it's, like, good against the mid-range derpy decks. But, you know, like, against a lot of the other rest of the format, it's just, like, pretty unimpressive.
It's great against everything that's not red.
Well, it's not, like, the limitation. Like, it's not good against, like, some of the other stuff, too. I guess it's good against Rally and Devotion and Abzan, and that's probably, like, a bulk of the bat.
Yeah, it's just great against everything that's not red, because red's too fast for actually off the bat.
Well, there's also the blue-red artifacts deck. That's another, like, reddish deck that you don't want to have it against and stuff.
I mean, I basically look at that deck as red the way it clocks you. Like, they're essentially, like, these super-fast aggro decks. So I kind of group those two decks in the same.
Yeah, he does have another one on the board, too, I see here.
Yeah.
And he's got Dragonlord's Prerogative. What's your thoughts on that card?
Card's really good if people are playing counter spells. Like, Jace's Ingenuity is garbage. I don't ever want to cast that spell anymore. Like, I casted it for a while, and I hated myself. So I'd rather draw 4 cards than 3 for an extra mana. And then, like, the kicker of, oh, I have a dragon. You can't counter this. It's just, like, relevant when you play the control mirror, or, like, someone has a stubborn eye, it's like, all right, I'm going to draw 4, and you're not going to stop me. So if you need, like, a big draw spell, it's fine. I think it's the best one in Standard right now.
Which card? Oh, the Prerogative, yeah.
Yeah, Dragonlord's Prerogative. Because it's an instant, you don't have to... Treasure Cruise is a good one, too, but, like, it's awkward to play Treasure Cruise and Dictate Time in the same deck, because in Standard, you just don't have the card velocity like you would in Legacy. Like, with a bunch of cantrips and stuff like that, so you're not going to fill your graveyard fast enough to play it. So
yeah, no, Prerogative becomes... In a control mirror, you want it, for sure.
Yeah, Prerogative just becomes... Well, it's just like, if you want another big draw spell. Like, right. For a long time, Adrian Sullivan was playing See the Unwritten. Or not
and
See the
Unwritten. Or Insight, or whatever.
Yeah. No, it's...
He's playing the one where you, like, scry a 3.
Yeah, 6 mana, scry 3, reveal the top card, draw cards equal its mana cost. Yeah. I can't remember the name of that card. That's going to bother me because I've played it on Moto and I don't like it.
I'm happy to see in the 18-point list that you linked to here, the link with all the 18 to 20-point standard decks, the guy in number 2 over here. I think we all – our good buddy over here, Mr. Yeah. Fan Chen Yang.
Oh, wait, where? I didn't even see it.
He went 401 on day 1, and I forgot that. I guess he must have done pretty well in the standard on day 2. I know he finished 8-7-1 or something overall.
Oh, he just had bad.
But, yeah, green-red devotion, and he trucked it pretty hard here.
spice.
But his list doesn't have, like, too much spice in it, except for, I think, his sideboard. Somebody told me. Oh, yeah, he was telling me he's got all these one-ups in his sideboard here, which is kind of crazy. Barrage
of Boulders.
Barrage Boulders. That card's the real deal.
Yeah.
If you're playing Ferocious, unblockable team, seems good.
What is it? Oh, Ferocious creatures can't block this turn. Yeah, that's good.
So, speaking of Greenland Devotion, I'm going to shift gears to another Greenland Devotion deck. Some people don't like him, some people love him. I'm a fan of Jerry Thompson.
All right.
So, he played in the Pro Tour, yeah. Right. He went 6. He was part of the 18 to 20 pointers.
Oh, wow.
It's standard. So, I'm going to bring up his deck. It's Greenland Devotion, something we've seen a million times. Nothing too exciting. But there are just some sweet cards here that I certainly didn't think I would see in a Pro Tour deck. Such hits as Shaman of the Forgotten Ways.
Oh, yeah.
For those of you who don't know, it's a 3-mana 2/3 human shaman.
You know why they played that, though, right?
I'm going to read it. I'm going to finish reading it real quick for the
viewers. All right, sorry, go ahead.
I'll let you interject there. Tap, add 2-mana of any combination you ran a pool. Spend it only on creature spells. And then Formidable, 9 green-green. Tap Biorhythm. Each player's life becomes the number of creatures they control. Activate this ability only if you have creatures with power 8 or greater. I have no clue why he played this card. I would have never thought I would have seen this card. And I want to know how many times he activated for Biorhythm and killed his opponent, because that seems awesome. But if you have any idea, please enlighten me. Why the hell did he play this card?
Yeah, so he played the card because there was a slight buzz and worry in the testing groups that there was a Turbo Fog deck that would show up. And this was one of the ways with Formidable that you could just kill them, as well as, like, against control as well. But so their Biorhythm was actually the ability they were going for on that.
That's adorable. So I thought it was just awesome, like, going, like, 1-3-5 and playing Whispered Elemental on turn 3.
I'm sure that's good, too.
I thought that was good. And then, like, you know, I didn't even think that there might be a Turbo Fog deck.
There was a Turbo Fog deck. It's I think it's Andrew
Andrew Cuneo, of course. Andrew Cuneo,
Omerette's Archive. That was your life.
Oh, game. His was spice. Yeah, I got to see this piece. I haven't even looked at it yet. I heard.
I'm gonna continue on the sweet tech for Jerry Thompson. A single Rogue's Passage. Certainly never thought I'd see this card outside of a Pro Tour draft. But apparently, you make enough mana with your gigantic Genesis Hydra to just.
Yeah.
This guy's unblockable. He's going to go through the passage and kill you. Hilarious. Absolutely hilarious. And the one card that confused me in his sideboard, 3X Trail of Mystery. So there's some synergy with the Whisperwood Elemental and the morph package that you just, you morph a thing and you go get a land, so you hit your next land drop.
Yeah.
I don't think the flip thing is, I mean, it's relevant, but what is this for?
I'll bet the Den Protector's coming in with that.
Trail of Mystery. Well, I know that the Den Protector's come in, but why Trail of Mystery? Like, what does it do that Jerry's looking for here? That's the thing I don't understand.
Well, that deck's mana hungry. You constantly want mana, and once you get the Den Protector cycling going, then you're going to be rampant growthing every turn.
It puts it in your hand. It's Borderland Ranger.
Okay. Well, I mean, similar effect, basically.
Yeah, not that busted. Come on.
It's like, I don't know if you guys played, like, StarCraft or RTS stuff back in the day, but you know you always wanted to mine more minerals and stuff, man.
Yeah,
it's all
sure.
About keeping your minerals at a constant level throughout the game.
Okay.
As Xu Ming says, the guy with the most mana wins, right?
That's fair. I'll buy that.
It's pretty janky, though. I mean, also Jerry T, just like, you know, he has his crazy choices and stuff.
Jerry T is what he is. And then sort of the last thing that I noticed, and I'll kind of surrender the reins here, the dead rested. There wasn't really much rally. There were a couple in the 18-pointers, and when I looked through the link that, you know, shows all the 18-20-pointers, but the dead were pretty much nowhere to be found. And I think I know why. Or I have postulation as to why. But it's kind of surprising that one of the decks that looked to be really big going into the Pro Tour weekend was just nowhere to be found. I think that's because the Blue-Red Artifact deck is the natural predator to the Rally deck, because it just kills you in 5. It just is like, put a thing into play on turn 2, 5 you. All right, untap 5U. Shrapnel blast you, 5U. Like, dead on turn 4. And so I think that's too slow for rally to set up and, like, get a value rally into a large enough rally to kill you. Right. Plus, the blue-red Thopter's deck makes a bunch of colorless creatures that block Nantuko Husk. So it feels like just that the Thopter's deck is the natural predator to the rally deck.
I mean, the rally deck was, like, the big bullseye. I mean, it won the Open the week before. And, like, all these teams tested, you know, heavily, obviously, for this. And, like, I mean, it was still the best deck, theoretically, in the room. But, you know, the mono-red and the blue-red artifacts deck both just, you know, pretty much destroy that deck. It can go either way, but, like, very favorable. So, I mean, you don't want all your creatures just getting Syrian-blooded, wild-slashed, shrapnel blasts, as you mentioned, and, like, clocks that can kill you much quicker than you can get set up.
And that's what I expected, kind of, like, after getting to see the results of the Pro Tour, that was the conclusion I came to. But at first, when I just looked at it, it seemed very strange to me that, you know, Rally just wasn't even there. Just nowhere to be found. So.
Right, right.
I mean, it's a strong deck, but it's also it's a combo deck. You know, you can hate out on it if you include the cards you need. Everybody kind of made some edges and stuff, and I think pros expected that. And, like, with the Pro Tour, too, these days, I mean, it's, like, so many of them work in big teams, like the Channel Fireball team, the P9 team, and, like, all those guys settled on, you know, the decks they thought could beat that deck and also play the field well. So, I mean, all of Channel Fireball was on that blue-red artifact, and all of P9 was on mono-red. So I think that's kind of how it broke down. They probably saw those decks were consistently good against pretty much everything.
Yeah, I mean...
And then the Swedish team, like Yol's team or whatever, was all the same list, too. I mean, looking over this, like, 18-pointers, that's pretty much exactly how the breakdown looks. Like, you either played mono-red artifacts or you played Devotion, and then there's the sprinkling of everything else in there.
Yeah, people getting froggy with their own favorites.
That's... Happy the mono-red list. Just, like, it looks sweet.
Which one?
Well, I mean, before Chicago, and I mentioned this in my other cast, like, the mono-red list that, I mean, the three that top eighted are very similar, and they're basically exactly what I had sleeved up, ready to go for Chicago. And then at 9:30 at night, I was like, I'm going to play Goblins instead and Audible. Yeah, I don't know, man. You know, I've been testing that one, obviously, and stuff, because I had talked with you about it a little bit. Like, so the night before Chicago, like, the change that I had made from playtesting where I'd added the Syrian Bloods main board was, like, basically exactly like what Stephen Neal was playing here, except, like, I had some of Yol's choices mixed in with there. Like, the three or four places where the three top eighters are different were the ones that I had kind of in a rotating circle in my testing, because those are the ones that, like, you could kind of go with whatever you want in that slot. But, I mean... The combination of, like, all the good one drops and all the good burn spells, it just is really good in this deck.
Right. Daryl, can we transition? Because I'm going to talk about this exactly.
One second before transition.
I didn't even see, Corey, your section has the red deck.
I have to say, Corey, that you and I get to eat crow here because we ragged on Abbott.
Yeah.
And it's in every single
I knew I shouldn't have missed this cast. You guys ragged on Abbott. Daryl has been talking about Abbott for like 4 months, man.
So,
all right, well, however long the spoiler's been out.
Yeah, like, after a while, we just kind of came to the conclusion of, like, why do we want a 2-1?
Dude, Abbott's insane.
Draws you a card sometimes, but most of the time you don't have lands for it. And so I guess it draws you lands, and so we were like, why do we want this guy? And we just kind of ragged on it last cast, and...
Oh, my God.
Now we get to eat some crow, and...
Right, right.
Well, we get to...
I think you just got to know how to play it. And I think that's like we said before, I don't know when this came up, but it's this kind of thing that really shows you, like, how great the design is of the game, because you look at those cards in there, and immediately obvious that they're going to be as powerful as they are, but when you see someone figure out how to use them in the way that they do, and, like, effectively, it's like, wow, yeah. I mean, like, it seemed obvious, you know, in hindsight, but...
Well, I mean, and even at first, we were like, I'll admit that I waffled and was, you know, swayed and then re-swayed and re-swayed again here, like... You know, I thought that card was insane and just going to be a nightmare for control players and just players in general. Yeah. And then I was like, but what spells are you really drawing with Abbott? Like, you have to have a bunch of mana to make it good. And if you don't, it's bad. So why do we want this card? And I was just like, well, it's an old Pro Tour deck, so apparently my first gut instinct was correct. But it doesn't feel right just looking at the concept of how
he's so good, man. I don't know. As a red mage, dude, he looks strong.
Yeah, no, and it's just like with my mental typeset as how, up to how red plays out, that, you know, we want to be very sleek and have minimal mana, you know, in play. You know, I don't see the second spell getting cast that often.
Right.
And I can respect that. It's an absolutely good card. Like, when you flood, it gives you, like, more things to do.
So I think he's very important for a lot of reasons. Like, there's a lot of lines that go with him. Like, when I first saw him spoiled, the day he got spoiled, I was kind of not sure. I was thinking about him still. I tried him out in the prowess deck. He seemed pretty good. But I think the reason that he's really good is this. I think if you look at him from a stats perspective, he's a 2-mana 2/1. So he's already a playable Grizzly Bear rate. Like, you're not going to, like, hate on that. He's, like, an average creature you would play in a red-style deck like this.
Sure.
But, like, prowess is a big ability. We've seen how good Seeker of the Way can be and cards like that for a 2-mana. Right. Like, we know that ability is strong. It's definitely strong in a deck that you know is going to he's going to be in, like, a burn deck or an aggro deck or Mardu or Jeskai or something like that.
So I guess you're just paying 2-mana for a 2/1 prowess, and you're just like, I don't care what else it does.
Well,
and that's good enough.
Well, that part's okay, but that's like a draft card at that point. That's okay.
Sure.
But then, like, the exile ability is super important here because, for one, like, he's often like a turn 3 or turn 4 play because you're either going to hit another land and play your 1 drop. You're going to centralize the list around a lot of 1 drops, including your burn spells, mm-hmm. or a 2 drop burn spell to clear the way, that sort of thing. Like, you will play him on turn 2 sometimes if you just want to. If you don't have anything else to do and you need to put pressure on your opponent, you could do that. And also, he's very good at, like, if your land's screwed and you have to hit a land, or if there's a card on top that's not a land and you need to get to land, you can exile that card to get closer to a land. So he's really good in that respect to, like, filter through your draws. And red doesn't usually have a lot of cards that draw cards.
Right.
So, I mean, to have something, like, the biggest weakness of red is that it runs out of gas. You can't get that last burn spell, that last guy, or you can't play 2 spells a turn. He basically solves all those problems, and I think that's why he's such a strong card. And one of the reasons why these lists are like they are is because they're all the 1-drops that you can pretty much play that are effective in this format.
You know what he is? He's the red equivalent to Den Protector, and we know that that's a good card, obviously, because
yeah.
he's played it in 4-ups now, but... It's
yep.
a 2-drop that you can play in a pinch on turn 2 to defend, but really, ideally, it's going to be turn 3, turn 4.
That's literally all you had to say. Like, when you said that, I'm like, oh, yeah, this guy's insane, man. Like,
yeah, he's very applicable across the board.
And if you think of it this way, if you wait until turn 4 to play him and you've got a land in hand, which hopefully that doesn't happen because that means you're flooding out, anything you flip off the top of your deck, you can cast because Firecraft costs 3, right? Or even Stoke, you can convoke your own dude when you play the land.
Yep.
But playing him on turn 3 before you play your land for the turn is fine too.
Yeah.
Playing him on turn 4 before you play your land for the turn is even better. So it's a
well,
fine
he's
card,
also,
but he's not a 2-drop.
He can be if you need him too, and that's also a good flexibility point for him. That if you need to play a guy and your hand's kind of light, you can just play him. Like,
right.
It doesn't really matter if you burn a spell, because all your spells are pretty redundant anyways. And if you just need a 2-1, and then next turn you have burn and a dude or something like that, then you can get the gas moving on the deck like you were supposed to begin with. But I think, like, if you look at Outpost Siege, which is such a good card for red that we know is very strong from the last couple months...
This guy,
one of the problems with Outpost Siege is that if you try to jam it on turn 4 or 5 and you're in a tight match, like, you're taking a turn off. Versus if you play this guy on turn 4, you're always getting some live ammo usually.
Right.
So, I mean, he is basically an Outpost Siege that is much more valuable in a lot of certain situations.
Sure, okay. But will it
late game,
will
like Corey said too, when you're flooding and stuff, I mean, he's like the best card you can draw because he'll always get you into something valuable.
Yeah, absolutely willing to buy. I just never, like, after thinking about it for a while independently and then, like, kind of bringing it up and discussing it with Corey, we both came to the same conclusion at first, which is, you know, like, in a curve game where like, you play most of your mono red games where you don't have a lot of lands in play, this guy just seems super awkward, and was what I was thinking. And so I started to, like, bag on a little bit. I'm like, draws you a card, but it's not really drawing you a card. It's like, most of the time you can't cast it because you're, you know, bottlenecked on mana. So that's sort of the direction I started to go, and now I have to eat my crow. And
well, no, Daryl, your concern there is, like, I think legitimate because, like, I think what people tried to do at first was build, like, the more traditional shell where, you know, you'd kind of walk all the way up the curve. And I think that's where Abbott can be problematic because if he's, like, the 2-drop that you have to play on 2, then he is much less valuable. So, like, one of the first things I did when I got to a list like this is that, you know, you realize that your first couple turns are usually going to be spent playing either multiple 1-drops on turn 2 or a 1-drop and holding up a burn spell. So, like, you're not forced to play him on turn 2 the vast majority of the time because you have better options.
Sure.
And I think that's what your list has to try to aim to do so that he's not, like, a reliant curve spell.
Reasonable.
But there's quite a few differences sideboard-wise in a lot of these red lists. Like, I don't know if you guys saw, like, you know, the Yol's school of thought, they had Satyr Fire Dancer and Chandra's versus the P9 school of thought where they had Thunderbreak, Regen, Outpost Siege to go kind of into a bigger plan.
And a mountain. You said another mountain.
Right, to get to support that bigger plan. And there's certainly pros and cons to both, but there's some debate. The Fire Dancer is not for the mirror, obviously. It's for, like, the white decks and the enchantment decks and stuff like that, but or yeah. Devotion.
And I was going to, so, all right, so hang on, I'm gonna take the reins for a sec, because this is, I'm going to introduce the same thing, and then, John, you go to town on it. The point I wanted to make here was that if you look at this top 8, you've got a lot of the same deck titles, but particularly the red decks are quite different in the way that they're, you know, like, designed in the thought process behind them. And, like, if you look at Yol's, like, he's very much, like, stick a threat, an early threat, and then protect it, right? He's running 4 Searing Bloods in the main deck, which seems odd, but that card is insanely good right now. And if your plan is to get the small blockers, the chump blockers out of the way for your, like, 4 Lightning Berserkers or your 3 Zergos or your 3 Fire Drink Crusaders, it does its job, right? Whereas you're talking about, like, Steve Neal, his deck is, it goes bigger, right? And it goes around that. And Chandra in his,
he just goes deck, bigger in the board, but he has the Searing Bloods main. And
well, he does. He's got,
he has Eidolon in the main, which is the main,
but he's not running the full 4 Berserker. He doesn't have any of the Fire Drinker Satyrs in there, right? So his curve is a little higher. It's a little, like, his average mana cost is higher for sure. And he's got the 4 Eidolons in the main deck. So he puts more of the lock in, like, sort of a if there is such a thing, like a mid-rangey burn strategy on. The Chandras can go over top, which are really cool. Now, like, that would not be good in Yol's list whatsoever, but if your plan is to play a little bit of a longer game and you want to get that Chandra going, that card can generate some insane swings in one turn. If it survives, you have to ping for 3 in order to flip it, and then you get 2 more damage out of it. But that gets over all the blockers that are in your way at that point in the game, and so does the heel cutter if that's something that you're curving up to. So my point being, these are totally different decks, and John, I think you're saying the same thing about them.
I actually disagree a little bit with that. I don't think they're that different. I think there's those 5 or 6 cards that are different.
All right.
Otherwise, they're pretty similar. But those are the ones I was talking about where it's like kind of the wheelhouse where you decide – or you decide, like, how you want to have the deck play out a little bit. Like, so those 2, like, the 4 Berserkers in Yol's list and the 3 Fire Drinker Satyr, in Stephen Neal's list, that's essentially the Eidolon slot. Stephen Neal still has 2 Berserkers, but he just cut the Satyrs and then the other 2 Berserkers. But
yeah.
I think, yes, it reduces the curve, but Eidolon kind of makes up for it because you get a similar amount of damage from his triggers and stuff, so it's kind of a heads or tails toss up. Like, I tried both ways, and they're both really, really similar. I think Neil's is better positioned for the mirror because he's got, like, the Eidolon actually can be really good in the mirror, and then he's got much more of a controller sideboard. But Yol's actually the one that had the Chandra. Oh, you're talking about the new Chandra, right?
Yeah, the 3-mana Chandra.
Sure, because, like, Yol's got the old Chandra Pyromaster in the board, and I think that card is, like, really strong in stuff like the mirror or decks where you don't want them to block anything. And same with Heel Cutter, obviously, in that sense. But the new Chandra Daryl, I'm curious to get your thoughts on this, too. The new Chandra's kind of a, I don't know, like a double-edged sword. It's a really interesting card. I don't know still if I really like it or not. I think I very much like it, but it's...
So we trashed that card, too.
Yeah, we did. We talked.
We trashed that one. Like,
well, I don't think it's worth trashing. I don't think it's trashable, but I think it is. I think it's a very interesting card. But
so it's so ambitious to flip. Like, that's a lot of spells.
To flip it is super easy in a deck like this. If it untaps and it lives, you will flip it for sure, without a doubt. I think the big problem is, will it live?
Right, right. And that's Daryl, we had this conversation last week, but like I said, I turned the corner on this one, and after seeing it and after testing it myself, like, it's a 3-drop, right? So on turn 4, you've got to save for some burn spells. It changes your line, right? And so if you're playing the game of, like, I really want to get that Chandra flipped, you might be putting yourself in a hole if they've got the removal spell for it. But if it works, it is definitely worthwhile, because the flipped version of the Chandra seems... like, to really close out the game.
If you play this card anywhere within the first, like, 3 to 6 turns, you're almost always going to have the material to make it flip the next turn. And this card is, like, insane the turn it flips. I mean, you're usually casting a burn spell to either kill something, burn them, usually attacking with things, and then it flips, and then it kills either a dude or it goes to the dome and it's at 5 loyalty. Like, the card is super insane when it flips, but when it's out there, it's like Rabble Master.
It damages them for the plus?
Yeah, the plus is +2 damage to your opponent, so like the clock gets super real.
This is why I thought the card was garbage, because I thought the +1 was to a dude, and I'm like, that's horrible.
No, like, the minus is to a dude.
Okay.
Which is still insane, because when you're flipping it, you're usually playing removal, so you basically get 2 removal spells a turn.
Yeah, this card is not as bad as I thought it was. I still feel kind of the knish on it, because, like, 2 spells is a lot of spells to be asking for.
Right.
From a red deck, when you're, like, trying to put all your artillery on it, unless you, like, slam this thing on exactly turn.
Well, even if you play it a little later, I mean, you probably have a guy and a Wild Slash or a guy and a Lightning Strike. And also, like, you can just ping them, too, with it. I mean, it just taps and pings your opponent.
That's what I'm saying. Playing 2 spells.
It seems like a hurdle, though. But it's, like, if you think of it as a hurdle, like, something you have to complete in order to get it flipped, like, okay, yeah, then it seems weak. But if you consider the fact that it adds 1 damage to every burn spell you cast, that's a different story, right? And then also pings for 1 every turn. Like,
sure.
The thing is, its initial
doesn't
function...
add 1 damage to every burn spell, because it only hits players with the ping.
Well, all right, so okay,
but still, yeah, go ahead.
Assuming you go upstairs. Yeah,
right, right. So I think that makes a difference in the long run, because you can get, you know, like, even if you do get, like, 2 damage out of the spell and they remove it, then it serves the same function as, like, an Eidolon on the Great Rebel. You know what I'm saying?
So I just want to point out, this is where you obviously see I'm not good at playing aggro. These are just not things I even considered. I'm just like, that card. Not that exciting.
Yeah.
Fully willing to admit. Really bad at this.
I think it's a metagame call, too, though, Daryl, because I think the drawbacks are pretty real there. I mean, I think... So think about this against, like, Green Devotion or against the Artifact deck, because I think that's where it really shines. They don't have really a lot of ways to get it off the board, and if it goes unchecked, like, it just does everything you want. But I think against, like, the Mono-Red Mirror, if it gets burned, it's awful. And that happens more often than not. Like, if it doesn't get burned, it's awesome in the mirror, but otherwise it's a super big liability.
Yep.
And then if you're playing against, like, Abzan, which usually runs, like, 10 to 15 removal spells.
It's not happening. Not happening.
So that's why I'm kind of, like, iffy on the card, even though it can be super insane. It might just be, like, a super good sideboard card. Like, jam 3 or 4 of them in the sideboard and, like, totally win those matches where it's good.
I mean, you can't run more than 2, right?
Well, the problem is, like, the list that it's in, like, these ones from the Pro Tour, like, it's in that slot where you could be playing more 1-drops, like you said, Corey, or you could be playing Chandra Pyromaster, which could help with blockers. You could be playing Heel Cutter. That's what my list in Chicago the Friday night was. I was playing 2 Heel Cutters in the slot where they have Chandra. And Heel Cutter is really good in this style of deck because you just basically want to get the last 3 points or 4 points of damage in and kill them.
Yeah, but, well, I still stand behind this Gav Clan Berserker. We didn't see a lot of that in the top eight. There were two in Pat Cox's list, I think. Yeah, two in his sideboard. And I think that like, if your plan is to, you know, to clear out the blockers and get in with your early threats, then that's a great card. Turn two, you've got, you know, Searing Blood or Lightning Strike to hold four, and then, you know, like, destroy the blockers before turn three comes around. You drop a land and then beat in with the Scab Clan.
I mean, I think it's underrated. I think you're right. I think it's a good card, but I think the reason why it's probably not bigger at the Pro Tour here is because I think the card's just really only good mostly against, like, Sultai and Blue-Black control, and somewhat, to an extent, matches where you can sneak it in. But, like, against, like, a lot of the decks that have, like, ground dudes, it's just usually never getting renowned, and that's kind of a big deal. Because then it's just an overcosted 2/2.
You got to test it. I've been playing it for so long, and it's so consistent. It's way more consistent than you'd ever expect.
No, I've played it a lot. Like, you can get it in there. And, like, I've played against it a lot, too, where, like, people have caught me when I'm, like, tapped out or tapped with my dudes and stuff. Like, I mean, it is good. It's another Eidolon, but it's 3-mana 2/2, so I think that's kind of a real thing, even though it does have haste. But if you're playing as Abzan and they, like, play Siege Rhino and Tassigar and stuff, like, right, that card's just not doing anything.
So, yeah, that's true. So, I think Sam Black had a couple of in his list, and I got excited when I saw those on camera. But, yeah, in the end, you know, the decks that showed up, like, to determine the winner of in the top eight, it's as small as a draw that could set the tone for that. And talk about, like, even the last game of the finals, when Sigurus, like, mauled down to three, like, I honestly think, like, his deck was poised to win that had he not mauled down to three. His deck was positioned better in that matchup, according to, you know, what I'd seen all day with.
He looked really favored, I think.
So there's such, like, little, like, subtle differences in, you know, like, how the games actually played out that determine who actually wins in that top eight. But yeah. I think, like, looking at the top eight decks, like, I honestly think that all those artifact decks are really the most, you know, most effective and most consistent based on the metagame that we saw on Saturday and on Sunday.
Yep.
Daryl, did you see the finals there?
I did. I watched the finals.
Yeah, like,
so it turns out that, like, if Seagrass draws that Soul Artifact, like, two turns earlier, he wins the game. Like, period. Wins the game.
Yeah, he still made it a game on three.
Oh, yeah. On a bowling into three, like, just, like, draws its Soul Artifact on turn three. Yeah. Soul Artifact, 5U. Like, and that's it.
His deck looks like, yeah, in that matchup, like, I definitely agree with you, Corey. I think he's, like, fairly favored because, like, Thopter Spy Network's super insane. Like, I don't even know if that card came in.
That card's not even close to his deck. Not even close.
What are you talking about? He has three of them in the sideboard.
It's not even close to his deck against that matchup. Absolutely not. It's way too slow. Way too slow.
Well, I actually don't know if that's true because it's basically the same position as Outpost Siege in that matchup for the guys that were doing that with the mono red decks. But
that's what Yol does, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what I can't remember what Seagrass brought in, but at the same time, you're right with the Ensoul Artifact. I mean that card's super insane and super hard for mono red to deal with, especially if it's on a Darksteel Citadel. You just, like, mono red can't do anything about it.
Yeah. Yeah, like, so if you look at Whirler Rogue and Thopter Spy Network essentially kind of interact in the same way, as in their 4-mana spells, they're terrible against mono red. Like, awful. You want to draw them, like, turn 100 when everything's done. Like, you don't want to draw them on, like, turn 4. You don't want to draw them in your board. So, like, having both of those spells in his deck is just, like, really awkward. And I think he's just, like, trying to do the Ensoul Artifact Ghost Fire Blade thing against.
I mean, he may have been trying to do that, but I don't know if I completely agree with that because I honestly, like, in playtesting, like, one of the weaknesses of this red deck is people who go wide on you. And so, like, cards like Whirler Rogue and that sort of stuff, I'm not wild about Whirler Rogue, but cards like Pia and Whirler Rogue, like, going wide is pretty good against that deck. Like, establishing blockers so that you can buy time to get back in the game. And then the Thopter Spy Network is a pain-free Bitter Blossom in most situations. So,
right, but it's pain-free Bitter Blossom you can't usually afford. Because you're usually dead or won the game on the turn that you're, like, casting it and starting to accrue value.
And that's one of the problems with going big. Yeah, I mean, like, if you guys saw, I don't know if you watched Yoel and Stephen Neal's Mono Red Mirror match, but in game three, Stephen Neal, like, tapped out on turn four to play an outpost siege. And personally, I thought it was a super bad move because he had other things he could do. He could represent other things he could do. Mm-hmm. And instead, he just, like, took a turn off and then died. So I think that's kind of the concept there, too, where sometimes, yes, Spy Network and those kind of cards, just too slow for what you want to be doing. But, like, a really critical key thing to any kind of mirror matchup like that is that you want to try to derive value out of your cards. Like, you can't just jam all the mono red one drops. Like, one drops are usually one of the first things that's sided out in a mirror, like some number of one drops, so that you can add more burn spells and more value spells and be able to survive. You know, everybody's going to play out their hand in those kind of mirrors, so you need some way to break serve, essentially.
It's this, it's essentially the same function as Outpost Siege, right? If you're playing a Thopter Spy Network, it's the top of your curve. You're tapping out at the top of your curve for something that doesn't have an effect when it comes into play. And if your primary resource in that matchup is time, which it is, right? You've only got 5 turns, 6 turns to live, then you can't be doing that.
It's tough, yeah. And I think given the position that some of these red decks are in these artifact decks, I think the go big plan is a little bit worse. And that's one of the reasons why I wasn't super happy about, like, P9's mono red sideboard where they went into Thunderbreak, Regent, and Siege, because I don't think you have that much time in these matchups. But it is something that red mirrors have done from time to time. Just depends on how quick the decks are.
Here's what I do. I take out those 3 Thunderbreak Regents and 1 Mountain. I put in 4 Scab Clan Berserkers in that sideboard.
There you go. I mean, Corey, you might be right on that, man. That thing, I mean, first of all, it's like cheap as hell. So if anybody's going to move in on it, you might as well.
Get it now. Hey, these decks are going to get played a lot in the next couple weeks because they're so cheap, or they were so cheap. They're relatively affordable compared to others to play. And now that they've, like, had their time in the spotlight, everyone's going to want to run them, right? There's new tech. This is, like, the first week since Origins has come out that we've really had a fresh metagame with the artifact decks and with the burn decks. But before this, it's been Abzan and Devotion, which we've been seeing for almost a year and a half now, right? People are always looking for new stuff. And already, like, if you look at the price of things, like, Abbott has shot up to $8.
And Firecraft, yeah.
Firecraft and the Scissors are $5 now, too.
I mean, like you said, we're going to have rotation here pretty soon, too. So, I mean, yeah, you got to start figuring out what you want to play. I see you got something on one of your links here. You got a Counters deck?
Yeah, I'm going to hit that in just a second. But before we do, I just want to say we'll have a quick discussion here. We're going to move on from this. But going forward, looking forward to next weekend, there are a few cards that are available to us that would be really good meta calls. I'm thinking, like, obviously, you know, Dromoka's Command is really good against the burn decks. It's a 2-for-1 against, like, Eidolons and stopping any kind of burn spell. But a little less obvious ones, I've seen people running Dragonlord Dromokas online, which is almost impossible for the burn decks to kill. And when they get in, they are a 5-7 flying lifelink.
Yeah,
the card's really slow against this deck, though. I don't think that card's very good.
It's late, but I've played against it a lot. That have coursers and that have, you know, other, like, good siege rhinos, you know.
I think the cards I would expect to see pick up against mono red, and I think they will because now it's got a bullseye. I think are like Feed the Clan and Irration Cleric. I think both of those are extremely effective. Ration Cleric's like the worst thing you want to see when you're playing that red deck.
Yeah, it blocks everything.
Yeah, it blocks everything. Like, you have to use, like, a Lightning Strike or better to kill it, and, like, it gets instant value against them. Like, it's just a difficult card.
Can we shift Timely Reinforcements again?
Please. Yeah, right? So, another one we've got. Here's a weird one for you. Someone ran this on me, on Cockatrice, and I was like, oh my god, that exists? It's crazy. This is probably too high on the curve, too, but Orbs of Warding is 5 mana. It's an artifact.
Yep, I know exactly what that card does.
Hexproof, and if a creature would deal damage to you, prevent one of that damage. It's everything you want against that deck, but the only card is 5 mana.
Card's a secret killer, guys. I played in a proxy tournament at Netherworld the week before Chicago, and I was playing my red deck, which is similar to these ones, and I played in the finals against Turbo Fog. And Sam was using, the guy who got 9th in Chicago, he was using that Orbs card.
And you died. It was over.
He played it game 2, and I was like, like, what the hell is this card? And I'm looking at it, and then it's like, oh, I can't play three or four burn spells in my hand. And yeah. all my damage from my dudes is reduced by one. My Eidolon is reduced by one. Like, the card is actually sweet. Like, Akiri, I think you're right that it's, like, slow, but if it's in a controller shell already, then it's certainly scary. I definitely thought it was, like, a centerpiece to that Turbo Fog deck. And then I beat him in game three, but I had, like, double Eidolon. So by the time he got the orb out, it was one of those situations where it was too slow. But
yeah, I've seen it run in a control deck, exactly. It was a blue-black control deck. And if following a Languish, you know, you play that after Languish and you stabilize. I bought three play sets of those. They're 50 cents each, so now's the time, right? I think
so many 50-cent cards.
At least a dollar, right?
willing to buy Orbs of Wardy.
It's right. Good.
So going forward here, there was a plus-one counter deck in there.
Are we jumping straight to that guy?
This deck's hilarious.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. We'll just point this out.
This guy's like an FNM hero at the Pro Tour. What the hell?
This is basically FNM here. This is like limited. It's,
what is
the Abzan ability even called? Outlast?
Yes.
Outlast. Yeah, it's basically an Outlast deck. And here, I can't even find it now.
It's the very bottom.
Got it in front.
Four Abzan Falconeer.
Go for it.
4 Honored Hierarch. I'm going to have to read most of these. 2 Ajani. 4 Abzan Falconeer. 2/3 for 3 with Outlast 1. Pay 1 tap. Put a 1/1 counter on a creature.
Oh, God. Don't go through every ability.
Yeah. 4 Honored Hierarch. 2 Servant of the Scale. 4 Avatar of the Resolute. 4 Mana Gorger Hydra, which is the new guy. It's like Forgotten Ancient. Whenever someone plays a spell, put a 1/1 counter on it. 4 Hangerback Walker, 4 Drones.
Hangerback Walker!
Yeah, in the plus-one counter deck?
Yeah, it seems like a good fit, yeah.
Yeah, it's a reasonable Magic card. 2 God's Willing, 3 Citadel Siege.
Woohoo!
Yeah.
That's so good, I love it.
It's the White Siege, Khons or Dragons. Khons, 2 1-1 counter on a creature. Dragons, tap a guy during combat on your opponent's turn. And then 4 Hardened Scales, which is the centerpiece of this deck, and I had no clue this card existed. If 1 or more plus one counters were to be placed on a creature you control, place that many plus one counters on it instead. So if your guy gets 2 plus one counters, he instead gets 3.
So. And Daryl, the reason you don't know about that card is because no one plays that card except for those randos on Cockatrice's court. I'm sure you run into.
Oh, so. And then the sideboard, the 3rd Ajani Mentor Heroes, and Ajani Steadfast. 3 Hornet Nest, 2 Hollowed Moonlight, 3 Valorant Stance, 2 Elspeth Sun Champion, and 3 Nissa Vastwood Seer. So he's just trying to, like, make it rain with Hardened Scales, essentially. Like, Hardened Scales plus Ajani equals 6 plus 1 plus 1 counters, because I made it rain. Like,
this deck's hilarious.
Plus Hangerback Walker equals each activation gives you 2 more babies.
Well, Hardened Scales plus Ajani is only 4 +1/+1 counters, but yes.
Not if you put 1 on 3 different creatures.
Oh, sure. Yeah, actually, that's pretty good value. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, this seems totally ridiculous. It has almost no removal.
That's hilarious.
I mean,
Citadel Siege is so good. Oh,
it has 4 Jamokas Canyon and 3 Citadel Siege. What more do you
I don't know how much you guys have played with Siege, but that card just freaking takes over games.
Yeah, it does.
So, what I'm really disappointed in is that there are no Den Protectors in this deck. Because, damn, Den Protector plus all these plus one counters.
Oh my god, you're right.
Beating, like.
You have Den Protector.
Yeah, like, Den Protector, I'll Citadel Siege it, make it a 5/4. Attack you, nothing ever blocks it. I'll make it a 7/6. There's not a creature in Standard that blocks it besides Dragonlord and Tarka. Alright, it's a 9/8. You're never blocking this thing.
Like, this guy's ever- like. Such a fun deck builder, too. He built, like, the red-white aggro deck that got popular with, like, 4 Outpost Siege and Chain of the Rocks and Monastery Mentor and stuff.
This deck is so sweet.
Yeah. I can't believe he's playing Honored Hierarch. That card's so bad, but it's like, I understand it makes sense in this list. I mean, he's playing Servant of the Scale, though, so I guess we have to go there first.
Awful.
That's
so bad. It's bad. But, John, on turn 2, you attack them with Honored Hierarch after playing Hardened Scales, and you have a 3/3 mana dork, with vigilance.
Not to mention Avatar the Resolute comes into play as like a 7.6 every time you
play. Yeah, some absolutely ridiculously large.
Oh, I didn't even read that. I like always see it come in without a counter, so I wasn't.
It gets counters for all the guys that have counters. Yeah.
What?
Yeah. This oh my god. This one's totally silly. All it's missing is the Strangleroot Geist. Can you imagine like some
or Kitchen.
Yeah, Kitchen.
Just like knowing curves though, and like how decks usually play out with set curves, like this deck definitely looks like it would dirtle hard sometimes. Like it's got like 6 1 drops only, and then
I mean you have to consider hard scales also being a one drop.
Yeah, that's like true.
It's like your combo card, you're like,
I didn't
turn one combo card. Yeah, yeah. Turn two, Hangar Backwalker, it's a 2/2.
Yeah, it makes total sense.
Avatar the Resolute, it's a 5-something. Servant scale, like, you just go off.
Man, scales in Hangarback, that sounds fun as hell.
That sounds really dumb. I feel
this deck looks sweet.
Yeah.
It's actually got some potential, huh?
This is
About that. There is no removal, like you said. There's Dromoka's Command, although we just talked about how that's kind of well-positioned.
It's got Valor Stance on the side. And it's got Elspeth on the side. That's functionally a Wrath of God if you need it to be.
Yeah,
so what would you want to play against if you played this deck? That's the key.
What wouldn't you want to play against? Probably Burn.
No, Burn seems fine. You have 4 Dromoka's Commands and a bunch of little guys.
You are playing a bunch of vulnerable creatures. Maybe that is the deck you don't want to play against.
Hey, but. So, all right, I got to step back for a second because I totally forgot the point I was going to make about this coming weekend. But this reminded me because it's got 3 Hornet Nests in the sideboard. That is the ultimate worst thing you could ever see playing Mono Red Burn, but it's also the worst thing you could see playing Put a Scissors on my Darksteel Citadel and beat in.
Which card?
Hornet's Nest.
Hornet's Nest.
So, if I were going to DC this weekend, I would be sleeving up green red bees and maybe even splashing white for Dromoka's Command.
I would laugh at you if you sleeved up
green. Dude, I wouldn't laugh, Daryl. I think actually, Corey, I think that's a really good choice.
Deck is insanely good. You know, the it has deck potential just as a green red ramp deck on top of that.
Can I have a second? I would laugh at you because the open is Legacy.
Oh.
Then. I guess that would be a
point. But in the 5K, I would laugh you out of the building. But yes.
Man, the bees, though, like in standard, you know, it's such a metagame poaching deck. But yeah, I mean, Corey, if you're going to play that anytime, that's kind of a solid choice because super good against Mono Red, super good against Devotion and Abzan. There you go.
Yeah. Are we just going to go Oprah and just bring on the bees?
You know what you got to be able to beat, though, if you're playing that deck? You definitely have to have a plan for Rally, because I think Rally's really good against you.
So this is why you play Abzan bees.
Yeah, well, that's when you Setessan Tactics and you have your Hornet's Nest fight the Nantuko Husk.
The main thing you'd have to stop against them is the Enter the Battlefield triggers, so as long as you have a plan for that, I think you're okay. Because the rest of your deck can handle what's going on.
Okay.
Fleshwing Griff?
We were talking about that on the other cast. I don't know if Fleshwing is flexible enough right now. Like, you could play it, I guess, but...
if you go
the bees wasn't white, though, right? The bees is just green-red.
It's green-red, but you can splash white for Dromoka's Command, but then you can also have Hollowed Moonlight in the sideboard.
True. Yeah, what about Hollowed Moonlight? That card crushes Rally.
That's probably what you would play if you splash for the white.
Yeah, I don't know if
splash is good enough, though, but...
Or you could just play Abzan Bees and play like the Tormod's Crypt creature. That's like this is a terrible idea.
Yeah,
I always think Agent Erebos because I'm like used to seeing Constellation decks and just like every turn you Tormod's Crypt them multiple times.
Yeah, you could. I mean, because the deck has 3 or 4 Court of Callings in it, so you can fetch out the Anafenza. I don't know, whatever. It's a thing. But think about it, bees. Let's go on.
Bees. So Mark Rosewater made an announcement today about, everybody hopefully knows about already, but Zendikar, the new set's going to have full art lands again. Yay! And no fetches. Boo. However, according to everybody I've talked to, it made sense to not have the fetches, even though I don't really see all their points, but I understand they don't want too many enemy lands right now, and it could come in the next set, or it could get printed in Commander, but good old Arid Mace on Scalding Tarn went on the old rocket ship ride.
Did they?
oh, dude, they did. We're looking at it. We see the Rosewater announcement. I go on TCG. I'm like, all right, well, this is going to get crazy. And I'm seeing the TCG. I'm looking at Arid Mesa. It's like $27 or something like that. Look at Scalding Tarn. It's up there a little ways, too. You know, it's normal price.
Yeah.
I look back in 10 minutes. There's one Scalding Tarn non-foil left on TCG Player. And it's like $140. And Arid Mesa is like, you know, I don't know, one up 20 bucks or something.
Okay.
So, yeah, people went like fear mode or spec mode or whatever the hell they want to do with it.
Bananas mode. I hope they just print in the commander set and makes you look stupid.
Well, it might just come out in the second set of Battle for Zendikar because I think, like, Mark Rosewater was talking about how they're going to have a new set of lands. And the guesses right now are that they'll either have the enemy-colored man lands, because in the first, I think it was in Zendikar where we got the...
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, Colony for a bit. Yeah, it was World Wake, but yeah.
Or World Wake, yeah. So then they might have the enemy-colored man lands, or they might just have a brand new land altogether. So there maybe like filters or something. I don't know. There's a lot of speculation, but...
Yeah, he does say it's a brand new design. So I'm thinking that means it's not a like another mainland, you know?
No, no chance.
I mean, if it doesn't make sense, I guess that's fine. But I'm getting like super burnt out with Magic, like, or with Wizards, just making this game so expensive.
Yeah.
Like, saying they don't care about the secondary market and then losing people to the game.
But what can they do, you know? Like, I mean, short of actually just printing them in this set in the first place.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I guess this is just the cycle they have to follow. But I mean, yeah. I feel like you guys talked about the modern decks being, you know, north of $500.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, do they want people to play their game? I mean, I guess it's very popular right now, but that's a freaking car, man. That's like a used car.
All right.
That's pretty sad. I don't know. All right, I'm just being the like grumpy old man now.
So this announcement came today on Mero's blog. And
sure.
So just today, Scalding Tarn is up to $80 from $50. It's up $30. So I'm interested to see what it's going to be like next week and even going forward. But
Benjamin,
there's got to be a reprint inside, right?
Benjamin, I'm calling it. Next week, Scalding Tarn will be $100.
Yeah, all right. What's this going to do to the cons fetches? How about that? They're going to
It'll
too,
push
right?
them north of 30, I think, until
the cons fetches?
Yeah, I think the cons fetches are going to go up too because it's what people have to deal with for modern.
No.
If you want to play modern, you've got to run fetches, right?
I don't think it's going to affect it at all.
I think so. I think it'll go up a couple bucks.
Corey, there's so much in print, though, man. There's so much extra cons fetches, so much in print, and they're so dirt cheap right now.
Well, I'm not necessarily talking about like right now because obviously they're still getting opened.
What are you talking about?
But I mean, like say that the Zendikar fetches were reprinted in the next set. All right, we imagine that the cons fetches would stick around like $15 to $20 somewhere down the line here. I think the cons fetches are going to go up even higher now to $20, $25 at the same point in time that they would have been, you know, $10 cheaper had the Zendi fetches been reprinted.
I think we've talked about Saffron Olive on this podcast before. He's like a big finance guru guy, and he was very much against that theory. And he was talking about how the fetches he expects to be dirt poor from cons for quite some time, you know, maybe long-term spec. But I think there's just way too much in print for them. And, like, there's not enough market pressure there that I think they would go up $5 to $10. That seems like quite a bit for cards that everyone has four ofs already of and that there's a ton of extra circulation.
That's true. I mean, if you look at, like, the Temple Garden right now, it's, like, south of $10. In fact, the old ones, the Ravnica ones...
Are you talking about Shocks or Fetches?
Well, no, I'm comparing them to Shocks, because Shocks were recently reprinted, and they had a similar, like, price trajectory, where they went down to, like, $8 or $9 when they were in Standard. But the Shocks, before they were in Standard, were, like, $40, right?
Yeah, but then when they got printed, obviously, they're like cons, they became, you know, dirt cheap, and they're still really cheap. Like,
right.
The Shocks, there's still, like, a bunch that are under $10,
and
they're
point,
out of print, too.
They haven't started to go up yet. I mean, some of them have. They're up, like, you could probably get a Steam Vents for $12, $13.
Right.
Is that what it is? I'm looking up
now. That is what
but
it is.
But
I think
the Shocks,
like,
have not really risen that much since they've been out of print now.
Well, they've been out of print for a very short period of time. There's still a lot in circulation, and Ravnica was open pretty heavily. So I think stuff like that, it's not like when the Shocks and Fetches first came out. There's just so much more that's printed now in these print runs that, and so much more that's opened, that I think it's going to take a couple years. Like, I think there's certainly that ballpark if you want to make, like, a four-year spec or something. But I think there's, you know, a good three, four, five, six times as much as there used to be with the older sets.
So then if that's the case, Wizards is actually doing a good job of curbing their prices, right?
Well, the problem is, like, the modern staples. They want this format to be big. They've got to... Yeah, I'm saying the problem is that, like, a lot of modern staples, maybe not these particular ones we're talking about, but in general, are so expensive.
Yeah.
Go with Bob Cryptic.
Yeah, I mean, if they want people to play the format, I mean, they've been trying to do it. They've been attacking from different angles with that, and, like, they're trying to push the whole Modern Masters stuff, but, like, still not solving the problem. I mean,
Spell Skite's still $20.
Yeah, I mean,
they've got a fine line to walk, though, because think about this. Standard cards right now... The heavily played standard cards are still $20. Like, we're talking about the Raptors and stuff, and the Raptors aren't even showing up in every deck right now.
Or in any other format.
Dragonlord Ojutai, $20, and they're not even going to be $20 in a year's time when they recycle out. So I think that's fair to pay for the ones that are played in almost every modern deck. You know, like, I would say that 70% of modern decks have Spellskite, maybe not.
All right, 50%. Sure. All right, you ready? I got one. You have no argument.
All right, go for it.
Blood Moon.
All right, Blood Moon.
Card's $50 for no reason.
Because it's first of all, it is very good in Modern, but
right.
Yeah, it's $50 though, which is ridiculous. I mean, it's actually come down a little bit, but still, $36 for Blood Moon is absurd.
So they've got a fine line to walk though between, like, making everyone happy who wants to get into the format and not pissing everyone off who's already in the format and has invested all that money, right? So, and so they deal with those things.
Well, they already did that with bannings though too. So I mean, yes, to some extent. But
let me explain it to you this way. I played this game. I think, John, you played a little longer than I have because I'm a little younger than you are.
But
I've invested a ton of money into playing Legacy. I would give zero damns if they tank the price of my collection. So that I could play decks that I wanted to try and play without having to make major manipulations to my collection.
Yeah.
And let everyone else play so that people that have new ideas and fresh takes coming from different formats would come with something different to the table.
As a player, I think that attitude's correct. As someone who does spec buying, someone who runs businesses and stuff, there's worry in terms of how you make your investments there. Like Legacy, you can invest in the unreprintable cards, but if Modern's become a big format and you want to invest in it from an investment standpoint, the risk is getting, like, scarier and scarier if they're going to randomly reprint stuff.
It's a game, not an investment, people.
Well, that's true. Listen, I agree with you 100%, Daryl, and I would be delighted if every single Modern staple was reprinted in lore below $10. But there are people that are not that way. You know, that's what I'm saying. Like, there's a large percentage of players out there that do not play in the same way, you know, and they maybe value their cards more because they are, like, literally just monetarily more expensive than other cards or something. You know, they're, like, invested more financially in the game than you know.
Right, but I'm not discounting. I've sunk a bunch of money in this game.
Right.
But just conceptually, the idea of, you know, I don't want to have to hunt for a four-round Legacy tournament.
Yeah.
I don't want to have to dig deep to find, you know, a Modern career event where I can go play 8 rounds of Modern.
So yeah, you're saying cards should be affordable, right?
I would rather tank the cards and let you play the game.
I agree. I think all three of us want that.
You know, and that's just because, like, it's not even a convenience thing. It's just, like, availability. Like, would I rather have value in owning the cards,
mm-hmm.
or have readily available access to put the cards to use? So
I think the concern too that Corey you mentioned of, like, players who have invested a lot not wanting cards to tank, I think all three of us probably agree that should be a lesser value weighted thing than making the format accessible and the cards easier to obtain.
Right.
I mean, you know, you need people to play your game, and you want more business and more people to play your game. So I think if they really don't care about the secondary market, they need to be more aggressive on that. I mean, if for people like Daryl and I who played for a long time, we've seen the days where cards simply just weren't anywhere close to this expensive. This is abnormal inflation versus regular gradual inflation.
Yeah. When did you guys start playing? What was your first?
I started in Revised. I was like 10 years old.
Okay.
What about you, Daryl?
I started in Onslaught. I was like 9.
Okay. I started playing in Masks, Mercadian Masks. What was, like, think about, like, that era, like, the Urza's sets. What was the most expensive thing that was played in Type in the Type 2 format in, like, Urza block?
Because
I want to say that
Solarian Academy was like a $20 rare. Like,
so I don't, yeah, I don't know
close
about
to what it is today.
$20 rare was about the average kind of.
I don't know
in
about
most
Urza's block, but like when I started playing, it was like right, you know, right there in the Goblins era into the Skullclamp era. So like you got to see your first like $8 uncommon with Skullclamp, you know, and Isochron Scepter. Ravager was like 25 or 30 bucks. Fetchlands were like 20 bucks. Mm-hmm. Tooth and Nail was like $15. And that was like the centerpiece of a deck. You know, Goblins, oh. Aether Vial. Aether Vial was like a $6 uncommon. And that
I mean,
was
a hard
like
point
a big
to,
deal.
Yeah, but a hard point to compare. It was a big deal to us back then. But like a hard point to compare is that, you know, we're looking at like Standard back then. When now we actually have the multiple formats where you have older formats with tons of out-of-print cards. So I think that, I mean,
Legacy
yes, there's going to be more money.
Like,
yeah,
it's
Legacy
not
was a thing, but it wasn't like the cards were, like, super ancient or, like, hard to, like, super hard. It wasn't Legacy of today, you know, where you have,
sure.
Like, the cards, they should get much more valuable for very good reasons, but I think, like, the inflation level is obviously just crazy right now.
Right,
correct.
Right.
And for what it's worth, Legacy inflation is probably much more stable than Modern, you know, because of the fact that you have the reserve list and, like, entrenched deck lists and stuff like that.
I mean, so, like, now Legacy costs are relatively smooth, but you will see the most random spikes of, like, crazy.
Well, stuff like Snapcaster and Liliana and that sort of stuff, for sure, because of the accessibility and other
things. But in like Force of Will, the price is jockeyed up and down. Rashad Port, Wasteland,
yeah.
Like it kind of stabilized, but like there were spikes where it spiked and then like Price Memory pushed it down, but Price Memory held it at a higher point. So
there
like,
were some big spikes for that, yeah. I sold some buddies' cards and stuff when that was going on, but like I think part of that was like there was big speculators and big buyers that moved that like significantly because they've always talked about how there's people that really own like good percentages where they can make a physical change in the market versus like anything Wizards is doing that made those kind of changes.
Yeah, Wizards has some trouble.
I mean, sometimes like a new card gets printed that makes another card much better. So sure, then those cards will spike. But that's like natural inflation if that stuff happens.
Well, I'd make the argument that the fact the inclusion of mythics into the print run had a lot of effect on you know like just
yeah,
the
that's
financial
true.
Stability of the game. And you're talking like buying a pack for $4, and like the gamble you're taking has much greater risk when anything that's non-mythic is just poised to be much cheaper. Because of the fact that it's so much more available than those Chase Mythic cards, and you just have to buy that many more packs to get those freaking Mythic cards that you need.
So, I'm a huge fan of finance, but I saw this like thing in our show notes, and I want to get to it because it's freaking awesome.
All right, let's go to this.
There's an Allies deck.
Oh yeah, you want to talk about that? This is our juicy deck tech.
Dude, this deck is sweet. Play the bumper. So, this is a sweet one from Italy. PPTQ and Modern. Third, fourth, Allies. We got some Caverns and some various colored lands and various varieties. Four Kazan New Blademaster, four Hada Freeblade, Kibir Am Angel, Oku Battlesinger, Harbaz Druid, Orin Reef Survivalist, Talus Paladin, Adaptive Automaton, Path, Collective Company, Boros Charm, Aether Vial.
Okay,
and then some just like random
you're gonna have to
cards.
Read some of those because I think you just like rattled off a bunch of like limited cards circa
2009. It's all this is the old Standard Allies.
I rattled off the whole deck and then I kind of like circle back. So like the big ones are Hada Freeblade and a 1-mana 0/1. Pretty much all the Allies have a when they enter the battlefield or another ally enters the battlefield,
do a thing. Hada Free Blade gets a +1/+1 counter. Kazandu Blademaster's a 2-mana, 1/1 Vigilant First Strike, gets a +1/+1 counter. You got guys that make mana, guys that give your team protection from all colors, except the, and that's Kibir Air Angel, protect from all colors, guys that give you guys haste, so stuff like that. So basically, the allies snowball. Once you put one in play, then you put the second one in play, now two guys are doing something, the third one makes three guys do something, and so it snowballs. So like, it can get pretty out of control pretty quickly with Collected Company. So this is not necessarily a combo deck, just a reasonable aggro deck. A lot of the ally builds I've actually seen lately were Return to the Ranks / Rally the Ancestors combo decks with the blue ally that mills them for the number of allies you control. You can mill either player.
Yeah, that used to be a thing, yep.
So Rally the Ancestors with that guy and the clone. You can make multiple copies of the blue 2-mana ally that mills them,
yep,
and just mill your opponent out. So, like, that's a combo deck. So he decided to go the more aggro deck. He had a couple of Return to the Ranks in the sideboard for just a little bit of two CMC mana cost recursion, but just a really sweet aggro deck that snowballs. Collect the Company fits the allies theme really well. Harbaz Druid can power it out on turn three. So it's actually just a really fun deck to play. But Aether Vial and Cavern giving your creatures uncounterability. Adaptive Automaton, kind of a weird one. Picked creature type. It's also the creature type, and creatures of the type give us +1/+1. So it's a lord, and it comes to play as an ally and triggers all your other allies.
Yeah, it's a double lord. That's why you play
it.
The creatures here also, like, this is almost like stock standard allies from when it was a standard deck. Right? It's kind of cool to see it. Like, the new cards are all the spells, basically, here. Like, the Path,
yeah,
the Collect, the Company, the Aether Vial.
So
his,
like,
sideboard looks sweet, too.
Yeah, his sideboard's very nice. Four Suppression Field, which is a 2-mana enchantment. Pay 2 extra for every activated ability you activate that's not a mana ability. So Fetch Lands cost 2 mana. Planeswalkers cost 2 mana. You know, Man Lands cost 2 extra mana. 2 Ondu Player, which is a life gain ally, comes to play. Triggers, gain a life for each ally you have. Ancient Grudge, 2 Core Firewalker, 2 Return to the Ranks, 2 Wear Tear, 2 Spellskite. So pretty straightforward. Yeah, the ally builds came in all flavors. They were white XX, where you could splash, like, red-green, or blue-black, or black-red. So you could do, like, all sorts of crazy different color combinations with these. But these were just a really sweet standard deck. And so I love to see, like, Cavern of Souls breathe life into an old favorite, so to speak.
Yeah. I'm a little concerned about having 4 Collected Company and 4 Aether Vials in the same deck. Seems like...
Yeah, not great.
Yeah, he's got a lot of spells.
I personally wouldn't play either of those cards, and I would just play all the reanimation effects and play, like, the combo version, because it's way cooler.
I can't say that without... well, yeah, or, like, I'm trying to think what they used to do in Standard. Like, there was that one card that's using EDH that makes clones, but if you get to 9 mana or something, you can do 5 clones or something.
Right, like a replication?
That. Yeah. Too janky, but I think the other thing I don't like about this list, besides the fact that he's got too many spells, is that... he is, like, he really doesn't have a lot of answers to, like, Bloom Titan or Grizzlebrand or any of those sort of decks. He's got Path to Exile, and that's pretty much it.
You're just racing. You're just like, hope you don't kill me on turn 2.
Yeah, that seems bad. Same with, like, Twin. He's got Path and... he's got Spellskite, too.
Out of the sideboards, Suppression Fields.
Oh, yeah, Suppression. That's
and
true.
It also stops the lands in Bloom Titan from giving the Titan haste and giving the Titan double strikes.
So
they also can't transmute unless they pay 5 mana. So, like, the suppression fields actually do shore up the matchups that you're like, what the hell is going on here? But it's just not something you would go, oh, yeah, suppression field, that's exactly what I want in my deck.
Well, no, in general, that card is super-duper strong in Modern. Like, yeah, it affects a lot of decks, but...
Not exactly how you would expect it to interact with them. You're just trying to, like, out of post-board... Bring in Suppression Field, cut Collected Company, and just, like, race them by, like, Suppression Field, ally, ally, ally. You're slowed down so much that I'm going to kill you.
That's the hope, although Bloom Titan can still also just play, like, a Prime Time or play a Hive Mind and kill them. But
sure,
it does definitely put a thorn in their side, which is the design of the card.
Yeah.
So imagine Mirror Entity in here, where all your guys have all these +1/+1 counters on them already. Those get
and then you set
to the
their
X
power.
That you pay.
Yeah, and then you set their power.
Maybe it's
yeah,
a
so,
and that's a little high on the curve.
Three mana is fine. He's playing a couple 4-mana spells. He's playing a few 3-mana spells. You have the green Harbaz Druid to power it out. So, like, I could see playing the banned version of this deck with the clone and the mill guy and just going all in on, like, I'm going to cast Return to the Ranks for two, for, like, six and bring back six guys. Or, like, the A Rally of the Ancestors for two and bring back my whole graveyard. Because, like, with the first couple mill triggers, you can mill yourself, put allies in the yard, and then play Rally and put all your allies into play and mill their whole deck.
I mean, I think that combo is powerful, but I think it's, like, way more disruptible in Modern, and I think it's much slower than this deck is. And I think, like, with the limitations that you have with a deck like this, you probably have to, you know, you don't have a lot of room to like, protect that sort of thing.
I mean, you're still playing your regular allies game. You're not, like, you're playing, like, 30 creatures. You're just, like, yeah, when they kill all your guys, you're like, oh, Rally, you're dead.
But, like, yeah, like, you have to rally or you have to get to, like a mid-game, late-game scenario where you can just play it out. So, I mean, I think that part, that's kind of tough, but it's certainly the more fun version of this deck, for sure. I totally agree with you on that. Like, it's sweet to do the mill plan with this deck. Maybe Collective Company's a little stronger there, too.
Yeah.
Possibly. I no clue. I just saw this, and I was like, this is sweet. I want to talk about it. Corey put it in the show notes. I'm like, that's the thing I want to talk about.
I think you mentioned that was a PPTQ in Italy.
In Italy, yeah. I'm going to slaughter the name. Daniel Mulatto.
Yeah. All right, so we're going to wrap up at that. That was our Juicy Deck Tech for the night. Thanks, Daryl, for doing that. If you're interested in the Ally deck, this is a little bit of a segue here. You might also be interested in the Modern Slivers deck, and I should say that there's one of those in this week's CKL plays. And so, if you haven't been to our website, we do a series called CKL Plays, and I run some fringe and some kind of new deck lists in both Modern and Standard, and I do a little series on those on the site. So this week was Scred Red, and so I faced off against a lot of Tier 1 decks, but also this Slivers deck that was pretty cool. So you'll see that on there. Again, that's cardknocklifepodcast.com. Daryl, you got our Twitter?
Yeah, card_knock_life.
Yeah, and that's about all the information we have for you today, so thank you. And shout out to Brandon in the afterlife in Detroit.
I'm sorry, Brandon. You were the sacrifice.
All right. See ya.
Later.
See you next time.